It's Tuesday, January 24th, and this is Geek Nights. Tonight, we talk about the Milton Bradley Game Master series.
Let's do this!
All right, so you may or may not know that I'm in the market to buy a nice new car.
Mainly because he drives a beat-up Tempo that barely runs.
It barely runs, for sure. It makes all kinds of noises, but it goes, so it's going to last me until I get this new car in a few weeks. So, anyway, I'm looking for a hatchback kind of car. You know, two or four doors, but there's no trunk. The back just kind of opens.
There aren't so many hatchbacks anymore. It's like Americans just don't desire them.
I don't know what it is. You know, you'd figure that for every variety of vehicle, there would be one per brand, you know? So for an SUV, you can get the Mazda SUV, the Ford SUV, the Chevy SUV, the Tonda SUV, right? Everyone makes an SUV, but not everyone makes a hatchback. The only really good ones to choose from, considering the fact that the Honda Civic hatchback is not made now because they're going to make the Honda Fit next year, and the Acura hatchback won't be out till next year either. My only choices are pretty much the Volkswagen GTI and the Mazda 3.
Now, the Mazda 3 seems to be a clear winner here.
Yeah.
I mean, we went with our friend Pete, the scientist from the other day, and we were test driving the cars, and Pete and I just played Mario Kart DS while Scott was test driving. And all I have to say about Volkswagen is that the salespeople are kind of creepy.
At least the one that we went to. I mean, let's look at the dealers we went to. We went to the Mazda dealer, where the guy was just kind of cool. You know, a little bit of salesman action, but, you know, he wasn't pushing it on me. And I, you know, it's like, you know, he knew. He wasn't a doofus.
We went to the Chevy dealer, where the guy was just like, here's the keys, see you back whenever.
Yep, that guy was very hands-off. But I think that's because we went in the middle of the rain when it was dark out and late, and he didn't care.
Plus, he's like, where do you live? And we're like, we pointed at our house.
Yeah.
We could see it from the dealership.
Yep. And then the Volkswagen dealer, they were actually like, you know, I was like, can I drive it? Because I expected it to be like the other dealers. They just gave me the keys and I went. But no, she was like, well, come into my little box. And I went into this little box and she gave me like this psychological talk.
German engineered, blah, 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 German engineered,
she's
blah.
Like, she's like, try when you're in the car, try to, you know, think about how great it is. And I'm like, yeah. Nice try, Professor X. It's not going to work. Because now I'm just going to be thinking about how annoying you were instead of the car.
Well, the one thing we noticed that, and Scott pointed it out, and I kind of laughed at him, but then we looked online and verified that it's in fact true. It's also a service center. It's not just a dealer. And there were a large number of cars of the type he was looking to buy being serviced.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wrote that off as, oh, this is probably the regional service center, and they send them all here.
I think it is the regional service center, and they send them all here.
However, there are serious problems with the Volkswagen GTIs.
Yeah, I went around the internet looking at various websites, comparing the two cars, and, you know, all kinds of user reviews, which are about as reliable as shit, you know. But a couple times, I tried to remember things that I saw more than once, because you would... And I tried to ignore anything said by someone who sounded like a ricer. Because there were people who were like, the Mazda 3 sucks, you can't modify it. It's hard to get parts.
Yeah, I think the funniest one is someone said they didn't like a car because the subwoofer that came with it wasn't powerful enough.
Yeah, okay. You need to get out of here. But I saw at least two times on the internet that there were reliability issues with the Volkswagen GTI. So then I was like, who knows? That's not from anything official. Then I was in the supermarket standing around, and I picked up this car magazine that had every single car from 2005 and 2006 with stats and a summary.
Meanwhile, I'm standing outside the supermarket with all my groceries wondering where the hell Scott went.
I didn't know where you went. I was just, because I had finished shopping, and you were still getting milk or something, juice or something, I don't know. And so I was just reading this magazine waiting for you to get in line, and then you were already finished getting in line while I was reading. But anyway, they said right in there, Volkswagen GTI, reliability issues. And another thing is, I don't know how many times this lady was like, feel those doors. And I gotta admit, when you close the doors on this car, it's like, it feels really solid. It's like they do it on purpose with like super hinges or something.
Yeah, you know why the car is so solid? Because it weighs like twice as much as any other car that size.
Yeah,
and thus it needs a giant supercharged engine to actually push it.
They like double steel reinforce the doors. That's why they're like that, which makes it real heavy. So it's a supercharged engine. And it might, I'm not 100% sure, but the Volkswagen website said it, you know, you should use premium gas and not regular gas.
Which I could see that, because basically I used to drive a car that had a turbo. It was a real fast car. And turbo, or super, in either case, generally means high compression.
Mm-hmm.
And not to get into a long technical discussion of cars, but high compression, basically the more you compress gasoline, the more likely it is to spontaneously ignite before your spark plug goes. That's bad. That causes knocking. And if you have knocking, basically your engine is 1 second away from shitting itself.
Yeah. I'm not going to go into all the other details about the difference between this car and the Mazda 3, but I'm probably going to get the Mazda 3. I'm going to call the guy probably tomorrow.
We're going to try to start a dealer war because there's two Mazda dealers around. Mm-hmm. I told Scott he should call one, get a price quote. Call the other one, say he's got this price quote, and ask him if they'll beat it.
I do realize that I just found a disadvantage in the dealer war, though, because one dealer's in New York. I just noticed in the little Mazda book, you know, the brochure thing,
yeah,
that the Mazda 3s sold in New York are somehow different from the ones sold in Connecticut. They have 7 less horsepower.
What?
Yeah, it said 153 horsepower in California, New York, Massachusetts, Maine, and somewhere else. So I kind of want to get it in Connecticut.
Well, wait a minute. There's probably more to it than that.
I know. That's why I'm going to ask the guy when I call him to find out what that is.
It might be an emissions thing. It might be a safety thing. It might just be... That's kind of weird.
Yeah, I want to find out exactly what that is, because who knows? Maybe if I buy it in Connecticut, bring it to New York, I'll have to pay to have something done to it.
Yeah, because, I mean, Dutchess County, where we live, there aren't emissions tests. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have car inspections, which, honestly, yeah. I used to live in Michigan, so the idea of the fact that I had to get my car inspected was an alien thing to me.
As long as it passes inspection, which I think it's kind of hard for a brand new car to fail inspection,
yep.
I'm all right.
But so the thing is, we don't have emissions testing here yet.
Nope.
And every year, the legislature is like, we're going to do it, we're going to do it, we're going to do it. And everyone's kind of, all the car people around here are always yelling about it.
Yeah.
But I could see you get in the car in Connecticut, and then we have emissions testing, and it doesn't pass some silly New York rule we don't know about.
Well, Connecticut had emissions testing for as long as I can remember. You know, probably in my lifetime it started, but I don't remember it because I wasn't paying attention when I was a little kid. But then there was an issue when I left for college that the emissions testing people, which was a private company which is contracted by the state government, was all corrupt, and the emissions testing was just this big sham.
Ha ha! I'm scamming your emissions.
Yeah, so they closed emissions, and you didn't need emissions in Connecticut for a few years, and then it started up again. I don't know if it started up again now or soon or who knows. It's a big mess.
Yeah.
The governor went to jail. God, who knows? He went over to jail over something else, though. That shows you how great he was.
See, it was weird in Michigan because they had emissions laws that your car couldn't emit certain things. Mm-hmm. But there were no inspections or anything. So basically, the only way you could get caught is if a state trooper saw smoke coming out of your car and pulled you over.
Yeah, and
wrote
if someone
you a
can
ticket.
See smoke coming out of your car, it's usually because you're burning oil, not because your emissions are too high. If your emissions are too high, it'll just smell real bad driving behind you. You won't actually see anything.
Yeah, and actually that bad smell usually just means you're running too rich, and we're not going to get into that. We're not going to talk about cars. Never mind.
We're done with the cars.
Yeah.
All right, so what's in the news today? Oh, the MPAA.
Yeah, the MPAA, and you know we all love them. They're just bastions of honor and righteousness, and they're really fighting for the little guy.
Well, I got to say one thing, though, in the MPAA's favor, they're not as bad as the RIAA.
That's, you know what? Yeah, Mussolini was an ass, but he wasn't quite Hitler.
Yeah, not quite.
Yeah, not quite.
You know, Mao wasn't quite Stalin.
Yeah, so the MPAA, basically, someone did a documentary film about them and about their business practices called This Film Is Not Yet Rated.
Well, it talks mostly about the rating system and how the group of people who do the ratings don't have to reveal themselves and how they're like biased against, you know, certain movies as opposed to others, and they give certain movies a worse rating when they don't really deserve it, and it's not objective, and it's all bullshit.
Now, it's a good movie, and it's worth watching, especially if you don't like the MPAA. This is just more fuel on the fire.
Yeah, and if you do like the MPAA, or you think the rating system is good, this will either piss you off or work to change
your
mind.
Wait, no, if you like the MPAA, I'm not saying if you don't know they're bad, but if you actively like what they're doing, stop listening to my show.
Yeah.
But basically, they got a copy of the film, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, to rate, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
And they made copies of it to distribute to a bunch of their employees.
Yep.
Now, I don't know about you, but as far as I know, it's illegal to do that without the permission of the copyright owner.
Mm-hmm.
And this copyright isn't owned by the MPAA. It's owned by the people who did the documentary, who in fact told the MPAA specifically, please don't copy this.
Mm-hmm.
Even better, and no one's sure yet, but they might have actually given it to him on a DVD.
Mm.
If that's the case, not only did the MPAA break copyright law and break a contract, but they violated the DMCA, the law they got passed on their own, the law they're trying to use to fuck all of us.
Now, at least the MPAA kind of admitted it. They said, yeah, okay, we pirated the movie. We're going to destroy and give you back all the copies, and we'll make it right. But if I was the people who made this movie, I would stick them to the wall with very large pointy bits.
Now, you know what's great? No one's sure exactly how this is going to play out yet, but there's been a lot of talk that the people who made the movie are going to take them to court.
Awesome.
I will if that actually happens, we'll talk about it more.
See, now here's the thing, though. It's like, if they win, then that gives grounds for the MPAA to do things to other people the same way, and they'll win. But if they lose, then it means, you know, they lost, which sucks. But at the same time, it means the MPAA can't win if they try it on someone else.
Yep, because if the MPAA gets you, you could just say, hey, fine, I'll get rid of all the copies I have, and yeah.
Yeah.
So, someone finally had the testicular fortitude to make us some audio feedback.
Holy crap.
Yeah. So,
of course, you send it to us in a WMA file.
Yeah, which, don't worry, we discovered a way to turn that into a WAV file in Linux. But just a heads up to all of you out there, we don't run Windows.
Yeah, WAVs, MP3s, and AUGs. That's pretty much what we deal with in terms of audio.
Actually, I've been running afoul of WMA a lot, because we're looking for a little solid-state device to record for when we go to conventions, when we're interviewing people. We don't want to lug a PC around or fiddle with ReSound while we're recording a bunch of stuff. We just want a little recordy thing. And all the ones that are nice and cheap record natively to crappy WMA files.
And
all the ones that record nicely are much more money than I'm willing to spend on a solid state recorder.
I think we should just use this laptop, or maybe get an external hard drive for this laptop.
Actually,
or get a new laptop. Or
I'm trolling around eBay for an old DAT recorder.
Mm.
Because DAT for
DAT's really good.
Yeah, DAT is basically,
we just need to get tapes though.
Oh, that's fine. I can get them. Basically, for anyone who doesn't know about digital audio and everything, DAT is the original useful digital audio format. It came out a long time ago, and it's pretty much been the industry standard in terms of, you know, recording something authoritatively and definitively.
And pretty much tons of radio stations used it instead of vinyl. And Japanese radio stations, I think, still use it. And Japanese people used to use it instead of cassette tapes because it's like 1,000 times better. But
now
the American record industry didn't want us having perfect digital copies of music, so we didn't get DAT.
Yeah, in fact, DAT, unless you basically, they segregated DAT into two classes of players and recorders in the U.S., and they made the ones that could record more than some piddly amount outrageously expensive to make sure that no normal people could get their hands on good digital audio.
Yeah, they just artificially inflated the prices so that, you know, real music people had to pay a lot and normal people didn't have access. That's kind of why they're screwed now, is because now everyone has access to perfect digital recording with the computer. Hence this show.
Yep. So we'll see if I can find a little DAT device. So anyway, Eric, for those of you who might not remember, is the person who's listening to the podcast on Sony PSP. Mm. And he sent us a nice little audio on how he did it and how you can do it. Let's
cool.
Listen.
Hey, Rim and Scott, this is Eric Glimpse, and tonight I'm going to tell you how to set up your PSP so it's an RSS reader. Now, first of all, you need to make sure you have a PSP and not a Nintendo DS, because obviously those things can't do what the PSP can do. And next, I'd like you to check if you have a wireless connection, and it needs to be hooked up to the internet so you can do this, so you can update your PSP to 2.6 firmware if you haven't already. Now, first of all, you need to go to download the PSP firmware. You first need to go to your settings icon on the left side of the screen. Then you need to move up and click Network Update, and then you can just follow the on-screen instructions, and those will tell you how to do everything, and you can just download that, and it won't take very long. And as soon as you're done with that, you need to go in and install your PSP 2.6 firmware on your PSP. And if you don't have enough battery when it's done downloading, it'll tell you to charge your battery. And the reason it does that, first of all, because it's like, you know, your PC, when you update your BIOS, is like, if you don't do that, then your BIOS chip will go out. So it just applies the same way to PSP, and you can go in and update that. So first you need to charge your battery, and then you go to the game icon on the right side of the screen, and then you move down and you go to memory stick, click that, and then choose PSP firmware 2.6. And then once again, go with the on-screen instructions and install that on your PSP. And after that, your PSP will reset, and then you can go in to the left side of the or the right side of the screen again, and go to the network icon once again, and then go up to Internet Browser, and then on that choose the button File, and then you can type in the address, like if you want to go to, let's you do this for example, go to podcast.yahoo.com, then click Enter, and then that page will open. And this is specifically to get Geek Nights on your PSP. And then go to that text box with tagline beside it. And then right in there, type in Geek Nights. And I think I've tried Geek before. Maybe it came up. But just try Geek Nights just to make sure. And then Geek Nights will show up as number one. And you can go besides that and click the name. And there's a link right there. And then it'll send you to this page. And it'll have like these two big buttons when you get there for subscribe or download the podcast, but don't go to that, whatever you do. But on the like the right side of the page, right besides the words RSS colon, you'll have a link. It'll be in like XML or whatever, and just click that, and that will tell you to subscribe to the download or subscribe to the podcast, and you can do that. And so then when you want to leave the web browser, just press circle and then select yes from that message box. And now you're ready to go in and listen to the podcast. So, now that you're on the main menu again, go to the network icon once again, then go to RSS channel. And there you can select the podcast you want to listen to, and you can stream it from the internet. So that's basically how to do that. And you can just prove how smart you are. And also, I've heard that with the new updates, you can actually listen to or watch streaming video. So that's going to be a new update pretty soon, and that's going to be really cool. Can't wait for that. And maybe we can get all our GameSpot video streams from there, so that'll be pretty cool. Now, I also have another question for you guys. Do you guys remember the Fear game that came out? I know you talked about that like when you were talking about how PC games were dying. So maybe you guys could talk to us about that. That'd be pretty cool, because that was a really awesome game, and I don't think it got enough credit for all the innovation it had. So thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Well, and first, I'd just like to say that Eric did put some nice music at the beginning and end of that, and no offense, it was well done. We only took it out because, one, we were very mindful of copyright here on Geek Nights, and two, there's no time.
I don't really want to get sued by AC/DC. So the first thing, the DS, I don't see any technological reason why the DS can't listen to podcasts, other than not having any place to store them while you're listening. But, you know, if someone made like a little flash cart for the GBA slot or something, you know, it can go on the internet. We just need someone to write the software to do it. People have already written DS software to go war driving.
Yep. So, I mean, and honestly, I think within some amount of time, there's going to be an official sort of web browser something for the DS.
Yeah, someone asked Reggie about it once, and he was kind of like, it could happen. He didn't say he was going to do it or Nintendo was going to do it, but he said there's no reason why not.
Yep. Because, I mean, the PSP seems to do this really well. Like, from what you said, it looks like it's really simple to update it and get online and all that. But I just got to point out that the DS has a freaking stylus, which is like plus 10 in my book for browsing the interwebs.
Yeah, when you were talking about like hitting circle, oh god.
That brought back flashbacks. Because I bought a Sony PlayStation, a PS1, for $100 solely to play Dance Dance Revolution back in the day.
Playing Dance Dance Revolution doesn't teach you circle, square, triangle, X.
So a bunch of our friends got the Naruto fighting game, and
that was a PS2 game, I think.
Yeah, it was PS2. And we went over there to play it. And one of the things in the game is whenever a combo starts, it'll show you a sequence of, like, triangle, X, X, circle real fast, and you have to hit them. And we freaking didn't know which button was where, and we couldn't do it fast enough, and we just got creamed.
Yeah. I guess that sucks for us.
Yeah, we were definitely only fluent in Nintendo.
A, B, C. Like Sesame Street, yo.
Well, A, B, X, Y. C was definitely Sega Genesis.
Well, C is also on the N64 GameCube.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. See, I didn't really play the N64 much. I kind of skipped a generation of consoles there.
Anyway, but it seems like the PSP firmware is pretty awesome.
Yeah,
and
I really...
updating it is pretty awesome.
I really like the fact that it has a nice little idiot-proof, hey, the battery's low, plug me in or something, otherwise you're boned.
Yeah, because if you try to update my firmware and my battery runs out, you're basically going to brick me.
Because, I mean, computers, I can see that if you're going to flash your BIOS, you know about that anyway. But I really don't expect everyone who owns a PSP to understand the concept of a BIOS or a CMOS. Because that is kind of esoteric knowledge. I'll admit that.
And you know what? I got to admit, it sounds like the firmware in the PSP is actually a lot more awesome than what's in the iPod, not the DS.
Yeah.
The iPod. Because pretty much the iPod, all this stuff is in iTunes. You need to plug the iPod in to get it to sync up. The PSP seems like it has iTunes equivalent in it, which is really what I think the iPod should be, because it's really annoying to have it tethered to my computer. I wish I could just, you know, subscribe and unsubscribe from podcasts on the iPod, and it would just download them wirelessly. That's what I really want. And it sounds like the PSP can do that, but I'd get it, except for the fact that it's really expensive and really big, and the battery life isn't long, and yeah. I have a Nano, so you can see it's quite a size upgrade there. Oh, and the last thing is you wanted us to talk about the Fear game. Actually, I know about the game, and I've heard people talk about it, and I know of its existence and what type of game it is, but I never played it. So I'm going to download the single-player demo, and I'll get back to you.
Yep, and I was actually poking around just looking at it. And it actually looks like it's probably a pretty cool game.
Yeah, it looks like some combination of like a Resident Evil, Silent Hill type of scariness with some FPS action.
Because, I mean, I guess when it comes to PC games, I don't think we're not really trying to say that it's dead as in there's nothing good out there. I think it's more of a it's dead in that it's lost the hearts and minds of gamers. And that there aren't many gamers out there who seem to delve into the PC realm to find the gems anymore. And I got to admit, gems are increasingly hard to find, but this game might be a gem.
Yeah.
We'll see.
But it is basically because the Xbox taking away a lot of genres that used to not be playable on the console, and MMOs basically dominating the entire platform of PC, there just aren't that many PC games worth playing anymore. So it becomes less and less intelligent to buy a crazy gaming PC.
Of course, luckily, it seems that as time goes on, you can play almost every good game on a crap OPC. I was playing Civ 2 today and loving it. Honestly, I'm kind of thinking upgrading my computer just because I do want to play Civ 4 and Half-Life 2. And yeah. I don't need to play them perfectly.
I kind of want to play Civ 4, but I don't really want to pay for it without playing. Maybe there's a demo of that, too.
Ah, yeah, check it out.
I should go for that, yeah. So at MIT, they got this crazy, crazy, awesome digital painting machine thing. You know, you've seen stuff like this before where someone takes a camera and they point it at something and the camera figures out what color it is and then maybe it, like, lights up a light in the same color or something like that. Well, what they got is they have this paintbrush with a camera in it. And you point it at something and then you go over to this special screen and you paint on it with the brush. And it paints using whatever the camera took a picture of. So if I pointed it at, a piece of green construction paper, I could basically paint on the screen with the texture and color of green construction paper.
Now, it's much more than that.
Yeah. That was just a normal leap of logic. Like something like, oh, I could have figured, you know, I could have thought of that. But that's a pretty interesting use of existing understood technologies, you know, and it's cool. They made it video. So this means you could, but the example they use is they pointed at someone's eyeball and the person blinks, right? And then they paint on the screen and you get a bunch of eyeballs, blinking eyeballs. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Just watch the video and you will comprehend and be amazed.
Yep. So a lot of you probably remember those magic eyes that were really popular in the mid-90s. where you stand there and you unfocus your eyes, and then a three-dimensional image appears.
I always used to put my face up next to it and then pull away from it, like the instructions said.
Yeah, that's the technique I saw. But basically, I learned early on that there's two ways to do them. And for the longest time, I always saw those things backwards because I crossed my eyes instead of unfocusing them.
Mm.
Basically, either move the eyes together or move the eyes apart. But luckily, my thing of the day caters to both types of people. And if you can do both, well, kudos to you. But basically, they used the same concept, and they made an entire stereoscopic animation of a little girl in Japan trying to take pictures of cats with her cell phone cam.
Whee!
And it's just really cute, cool. Just cross your eyes or unfocus them or do whatever you need to do to see the 3D image. If you're not familiar with how to do it, just Google around for stereoscopic images and you'll find instructions. I'm not going to go into detail about that here.
It had actually been a while since I'd done it, so it was kind of hard for me. But basically what I did is I crossed my – there were two pictures. So I crossed my eyes until, of course, then there would be four pictures. And I lined up two of them on top of each other to make three, but it was all blurry. So what I had to do is I had to line it up so that there were three, and then, like, I don't know how to explain it, but I did something to my eyes to hold the crossings, the remain three images, while also focusing.
He had a lot of trouble with this.
Yeah.
He just
I eventually got it. It was a two-step thing. Cross, lock, focus.
Now, the cool thing is, back in the day, and I should see if I can find it again, I remember someone made a mod or a thing for Quake 1 where you could Quake 1 would display on two little windows, and you could do the same thing and play Quake 1 in real 3D.
Mm.
It was really cool, but you couldn't play it for more than about 15 minutes without getting a headache.
Yeah, I noticed I had a real problem with it because I had to keep my eyes open, basically, to do it. And then eventually I had to blink, and half the time when I blinked, I totally lost it.
Yeah, plus if you do it too often, you might get your eyes a little bit out of sync.
Yeah, maybe that's why I had a hard time doing it because my eyes are so good.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
And in fact, some video cards have drivers in them where they'll do stereoscopic things.
Yeah, but if Windows Vista locks out drivers, you won't be able to use your custom stereoscopic driver mods.
So today, since over the weekend, we played an old game that we really hadn't touched since we were in school, we decided that we're going to talk about the Milton Bradley Game Master series.
And all the games in it, since the game we played, obviously, is in that series.
Yep, it was, in fact, the last and, as many would argue, the greatest of this series.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the game is called Shogun, though it hasn't been marketed under the name Shogun for quite some time, and you might hear it as Samurai Swords.
Yeah, if you see, you might see it in a store somewhere if you're lucky. I don't know if they still make it. I don't think so. But it'll say Samurai Swords, previously named Shogun.
Yep, but basically the four games in the series, and you might have heard of some of these, well, five games. Axis and Allies.
Conquest of the Empire. Broadsides and Boarding Parties.
Fortress America. And, of course, Shogun.
Shogun. Basically, what this was is when we were little kids, we didn't have awesome German games like are available today. And these are the most strategic games that you could buy in Toys R Us.
Yeah, these aren't life. You don't just roll a spinner and see who wins.
Yeah, and, you know, it's... They're very American games, but they're also very good games, and they're pretty much, until recently, they were the only really good American board games that were available to American children.
The one thing they all have in common is that the rules are horridly written. Mm-hmm. I could cry. I remember when I was a kid always having trouble with the rules in Axis and Allies. We never really played it the same way twice.
Yep.
And it wasn't until this weekend that we actually learned the proper rules of Shogun.
Mm-hmm. And they were actually, we messed up one thing.
Yeah. Well, but Scott messed up.
Yeah, but messing up one thing, I consider that to be great, that we got everything right except one thing.
Because a German game, they write the rules in this way where you know that if they say the word may, it means may. If they say the word will, it means will. It's very specific, exact, logical phrasing. And if something's omitted, it means you can't do it.
Yep, and even when it's translated to English, it's still perfect. I think that might also be partially because the translators do such a good job.
Yep, but these games are written in the American style. So the rules are just kind of meandering, and they touch on all the points back and forth, and they assume that you'll just assume things.
And sometimes the rules are like only really explained by reading the examples, and I just skip the examples because I don't need them. Because I expect everything to be in just the rules. It's kind of annoying.
Yeah.
But another thing these games have in common, which is why they were so popular and we liked them so much, is they come in real big boxes. Like, you know, the size of a pretty much a normal Monopoly box, and then there's a deluxe Monopoly box.
Three times as thick, wider, and longer.
Yeah, imagine a deluxe Monopoly box with, like, on top of itself. So it's double. That's what this is like.
And they come with lots of stuff.
Yeah, lots of fun little pieces and stuff. I mean, you think Risk comes with a lot of guys? Freaking Axis and Allies comes with, like, little tanks.
Little tanks, little infantrymen, bombers, aircraft carriers.
Shogun comes with a ninja.
The aircraft carriers are big enough that you can put the planes on them.
Yeah, it's just really cool to play with all the little pieces. And, you know, it's not like a crazy war game with the hexes and the little cardboard bits, but it's a lot more fun, especially when you're little and you're not a super hardcore guy.
Now, we've only actually played three of these games, so we're just going to talk about all of them as best we can.
Mm-hmm. So, the first one to be released, and perhaps the most popular, is Axis and Allies.
Which I used to play a lot when I was a kid with my dad and my little brother.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of fun, but then I got older, and I played it once with a bunch of friends at college, and I learned that the game is fundamentally broken.
It's not quite perfect. It can be fun, but it's not something you can play very often.
The Allies can't lose unless they're retarded.
Basically, yeah.
Unless they're functionally retarded and illiterate, the Allies cannot lose. America just builds up a giant army and then marches its way over to Europe.
Mm-hmm. It just takes a while, you know. If they're dumb, they don't get that army across the Atlantic Ocean fast enough, you know. Because a lot of America's troops and troop building capacity is in America.
Yep.
So it all depends on if the person being America and controlling America is knowledgeable enough about how the game works to move those guys across the ocean to get them to Germany as quick as possible, because Germany does start out with a big pile of guys, and you know, and I'm sure on BoardGameGeek, if we looked it up, there are people who have modified the starting positions and such of the game to make it more even.
Oh yeah, people have made rules mods that make the game a fairly good game.
Mm-hmm. Basically, the way it works is it's, well, Axis and Allies. It's what, Britain, Russia, and U.S. versus Germany and
Japan.
And you have this nice little European map, and everyone has there's a default starting position, and you put all your little units out on the board, and you can develop technologies, and you can buy units, and you can move units and fight them, and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yep, there's no diplomacy. Germany can't surrender or ally with Russia to take over the world on their own or anything like that.
That would be wicked cool. Of course, then people would just do that every time.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
I mean, basically, the game's real fun, unless you're playing with people who all know the game fairly well, because then everyone knows exactly what to do, mm-hmm. and the game is just deterministic, and the Allies win in the end.
Yep. But, you know, it's fun to play with little pieces, and, you know, especially if, you know, not everyone knows how to play, then, you know, it feels like you're playing something.
Of course, it is hard to follow the rules, because they're written kind of weirdly. And to this day, I'm not 100% clear on the movement rules for ships.
Yeah, I'm not 100%.
They're very ambiguous, to say the least.
Yeah, and not to mention, you know, all the things with the technology can sometimes get confusing, you know, when they affect how you shoot and move and all that business.
See, I mean, the strategy I always use is I usually agreed to play Russia or something, just because my little brother wouldn't play with me if I was Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd always be Russia, you know, they're basically the crap in this game. And my strategy was to do nothing but build infantry every round, no matter what.
Good strategy.
Never attack anyone. I just sit there and build infantry. And if he didn't wipe me out immediately, this wall of infantry, when I ran out of little markers, would just march its way across Europe.
Sweet. See, that's how this game can be fun, is you can do stuff like that.
Yeah, but if everyone knows what they're doing, that doesn't work. And then I have to use the actual Russia strategy, which is attack on the first round, attack constantly no matter how many troops you lose from the very beginning of the game.
Oh, that's right. One of the modifications is Russia can't attack on the first round.
Yeah, pretty much have to implement that to give the Axis any chance.
Yeah.
Because if you know what you're doing with Russia, you just attack immediately. You'll lose almost your whole army, but Germany spends so much effort stopping you that Britain just jumps over and that's the end.
Yep. All right, the next game is Conquest of the Empire.
Which we've never played.
We've never played.
At all.
I've seen it, but I've never played it. It comes in the same size box, and it seems to have a lot more fun pieces than the other games.
Yeah, little catapults and roads and little Hellas-like Greek-Roman guys.
Little legionnaires. They're Romans, I think. The legionnaires
are
really cool.
Well, you know what? They're Greco-Romans.
Ah. I've seen this. I think there's some road building and some. Ooh, there's a little. What's it called? A Roman building with little pillars in the front.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks pretty fun, but according to this, the rules are kind of also shady.
The game is pretty much completely broken, and it's all that matters is whoever has the most catapults wins.
Mm-hmm. It seems, though, like there's some sort of mechanic of generals leading armies, and you can do cool stuff like try to extort generals or kidnap them.
Yeah, if
them
you
and
capture someone else's general, you can just say, like, give me something, or I'll execute your general, or I'll exile him, or I'll jump him into my army or something. It looks like they can do a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, so if you can, I'm sure there's a way to fix the catapult brokenness, and then this could be a really cool game.
But I also saw that you have generals, and then you have your Caesar, which is you personally, and you can personally lead your army into battle, but like the game says, you'd better not lose.
Yeah. I think generally that's a strategy for when your generals are fucked and you think, you know, oh, I can definitely go save him if the Caesar goes out with an army. That
yep.
sort of thing. But I'm sure as soon as anyone takes their Caesar out of a safe place, everyone else in the game tries to go kill it. It's like, oh, there he is. Let's go get him. Anyway. The next game is one that I kind of want to like, even though I never played it, called Broadsides and Boarding Parties.
Everything I've read says that it's terrible.
Yeah.
Like, terrible, 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 not worth playing, terrible.
I want to like it because it's pirates, and I like pirates.
Yeah, we seem to like pirates a lot around here.
Yeah, there are plenty of pirate games, and one day I'm going to find a pirate game worth playing. But this isn't one of them.
Yeah, basically, we don't know much about the mechanics, but everyone says that it's just kind of chance who wins. And it's two-player. It's just a duel.
Yeah, it's essentially a duel between two ships, like a Spanish ship and a pirate ship. And they fight each other, and the pirates might win, and the Spanish guy might win. And it's just kind of random, and there's barely any strategy to it.
Well, have you seen that generally, it's very difficult to make good two-player board games, because a lot of the randomness in games ruins them if there's too much of it, because then the randomness matters more than your skill.
Yeah, you're basically just putting a big fancy theme on tossing a coin if there's too much randomness.
If you have a game that doesn't have randomness, the game's very deterministic and it'll play out the exact same way every time.
Mm-hmm.
So many games that are good, they don't have much randomness in terms of what you get, but you play with three other people and then the randomness that gets interjected is just how those people do, because you can't predict them,
yep.
and they can do whatever they want.
But in a two-player game,
there's just two people.
Yeah, and if you know, even if the game has some sort of thing where you can play it once, you play it again, there's only so many ways you can play it where the two people won't do the exact same thing every same time.
Yep. And this game does not solve that problem.
Yep. Wait, surprisingly, this guy says they sell well on eBay, but I don't know how true that is.
Huh.
Yeah.
So this next one, we played once.
We didn't finish it.
Yeah, we stopped playing. I don't think we really understood how to play.
I didn't understand how to play.
Fortress America looks like a cool concept.
It does seem really cool. Basically, you have this big map of the continental United States, and one person is the U.S. and everyone else is not.
The plot is that the entire world hates the U.S. and has decided to get rid of us once and for all, and we're being invaded on three fronts.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is that this is the one game in the series based on future and not history. It's like a theoretical future plot. It's not real and obviously still isn't real.
Though it's slightly predictive. I mean, most of the world hates us now.
Well, yeah, but all the other games are based on some sort of history. Axis and Allies is World War II. Shogun is ancient Japan.
Feudal Japan, not
feudal
ancient Japan.
Feudal Japan, right. I don't know the difference. Well, I do know the difference, but I always get them confused. And the other one's based on Romans or pirates, and this one is based on made-up crap. But it's still cool because there's a map of the U.S., and on the sides in the oceans, there's basically these columns, and whoever is not America, the bad guys, is basically cramming units into these columns to jam them into the United States.
Now, independent of all that, not only are there three large conglomerate armies trying to invade the United States, luckily Canada stays out of it,
mm-hmm.
but there are partisans within the United States who have taken this opportunity in the chaos to revolt against the federal government.
So basically the whole game is one person is the U.S. trying to hold on, and everyone else is trying to screw the U.S. So it's pretty much a one guy against everyone game.
Yep, and the one guy starts out at a huge disadvantage, but the longer the game goes on, the more and more troops he gets as America mobilizes for war. And basically, if they don't capture America and defeat it completely quick enough, they lose, and America pushes them all out one by one.
Basically, what this game comes down to is if the person playing America knows what they're doing versus the other people know what they're doing. You know, cause
it's a game that could be fun once, maybe twice.
Yeah, and as soon as everyone figures out exactly what to do for each side, I'm pretty sure that the same side will win every time. Although I'm not sure which side it is, I have a feeling it's not America.
I have a feeling it is.
Yeah?
If America knows what it's doing, I don't know.
I think if America knows what it's doing, but the other guys also know what they're doing, then they can just attack and destroy America before it even has a chance.
There's one cool game mechanic, though, and that's supply lines. So mm-hmm. all these invading armies are coming in, but there's this rule that any unit that's in America that's not American has to have a complete line of supply all the way back to their landing point mm-hmm. at all times. So if the Americans disrupt your supply chain, all the units upstream of that die. They run out of fuel and they just can't function anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a neat mechanic, and I wish the game were better. So
I think that's America's only real chance, you see, is to win, is to disrupt those supply lines. And my guess is that the people who are attacking, if they know what they're doing, can defend those supply lines against everything except, you know, some randomness. And if they do that, then America has no chance because America's only chance is to disrupt the supply lines.
Well, I was reading that apparently the game always seems to plateau where the three allies are gaining ground and kicking America's ass. And then the game plateaus and there's a small core of America left. But at this point, America just starts pushing back out.
Mm.
And then almost every time, America gets to the brink of losing and then comes back strong and kicks everyone's asses.
Maybe it's just supposed to play out that way every single time for fun.
Maybe it's a jingoist game.
I think it is partially a jingoist game. Definitely. But I wouldn't say I would recommend buying it. But it might be fun to play it once.
Yeah, it's definitely a part of board game history.
It has little fun little tanks and things in it.
Now, the last one is the one that is near and dear to us,
mm-hmm.
Shogun, which was renamed to Samurai Swords because the owners of the estate of the book Shogun were giant cocks.
Yeah, but it does say on the board, on the game box, previously sold as Shogun, in case you were wondering.
And it's a actually decent war game. The mm-hmm. only gripe we really have with it, other than the ambiguous, poorly written rules, is that it takes fucking long to play.
Yeah, imagine if you had a game that was really fun, and if the game lasted in like an hour long, it would be like the best game ever. But the game is like 3 hours or 4 hours long, so it's kind of like your fun is spread thin. It's not spread too thin that it's unfun, but the game would be like perfect and amazing if it was 2 or 3 hours, but now it's just kind of really good instead.
Yep, myself, Scott, and Pete played one complete game of it over the weekend.
Almost a complete game.
Well, yeah, I won.
Yeah, as complete as it can be.
Yeah, we played, it took about a little over three hours to play, not counting the time we spent figuring out the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And the game came down to, because basically the mechanics of the game are that you have units that you can put out in the various provinces you've captured.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have three armies, and the army has a marker on the board that's a unit holding the flag of that army. And then you have the units that are in the army sitting on a little board next to you, separate. So there are little provincial forces, whatever, guarding territories. But the real game are the actual conquering armies marching around and posturing.
So it's kind of like Risk, only less random. And instead of Risk, where you have, you know, just your armies are just normal and they're in every country all over the place, it's every province you have is basically weak as hell and has a few defending units just to, you know, hold the enemies at bay a little bit. And you have three really big armies that are like giant globs of units that are super dangerous. And they walk around the board individually, you know, conquering and defending.
And the whole game is them clashing because you start with three and they all have names. And there's actually a lot of color in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Every player color has three real generals from that era that were allied in some way or members of the same faction or what have you.
Yeah, and each general has like a different colored flag and a different shape. So that it, and those, often those flags actually somehow match the historic flags of those generals or shoguns and stuff. And all the pieces in the game are really nice. You have these really brightly colored guys and little spearmen, bowmen, swordsmen, ronin.
Gunners.
Gunners.
The Daimyo.
The Daimyo is really cool. The castles and the fortresses are really cool.
Yep. I mean, there's a lot to this game. And really, our only gameplay gripe with it is that it takes too freaking long to play.
Yeah,
it's
Koku,
really a fun game.
Like, the money in the game are these little Koku. They're red and with a little hole in them to look like real old money.
And it has a lot of strategic elements. There's no one way, like, one way to, I'm going to win. It's, there's a lot of posturing and yelling at people and diplomacy. And then you have money based on how many territory you have. And then you bid that money secretly. Like, you allocate where you're going to spend your money on secretly. And then everyone reveals simultaneously. And in addition to that, some things that you allocate money to are bids. Like, you bid on the ninja. So say I'm sitting there and I need the ninja because I want to assassinate Pete's daimyo before he marches into my fortress and kills my last guy. But then Scott seems to want the daimyo. I know that Scott wants the ninja because he doesn't want me to do that because he wants to go march in and take it. So I got to figure out how much do I bid on the ninja. I don't want to overbid because I need that money to spend on troops and such. But if I underbid, he'll get the ninja and I'm boned.
Oh, the ninja might fail and you might get revenge. Who knows?
Yeah. The ninja has some randomness associated with it, but you paid for that ninja and you chose to use it.
Yeah, and if you don't use it, you can always use it to look at someone else's bidding in the next round, which can be really useful.
And turn order, there's no... A lot of games have a right-left problem where depending on who sits to your right or left, you'll have it'll affect the game a lot. Like Puerto Rico is nefarious in this.
Oh, yeah.
And so is St. Petersburg to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But this game, it doesn't do it that way. Instead, you have these swords with numbers on them, and you draw them randomly, and then you go in the order of the swords, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
But if you want, you can spend money to choose which sword you get, if you want, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4th, or 5th sword. If in case you want to go, usually you want to go first, you want to go last, depending on what your situation is.
There are so many strategic elements to this game, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of color. Like, we played it quite a bit in college. And we have Scott here, you know, Rim and Scott, Geek Nights. We have another friend named Scott. And in two separate games, individually, independent of each other, one of them tried to hold on to this one area of the board that's pretty much impossible to hold on to.
Yeah, it's like right in the middle, like in between these two separate islands, and it's you're just basically surrounded if you're stuck there.
It feels like Asia in Risk.
Yeah.
And we dubbed it Scotland. Not Scotland, but Scotland.
Yep.
And the last game we played, it was going on pretty well, and eventually, like, all the armies are marching around, kind of getting close to each other and backing off. Getting close and backing off, everyone's kind of solidifying their position. And then the armies started fighting. And in the end, I had two powerful freaking armies marching around uncontested, while Scott's last daimyo and Pete's last daimyo were each holed up in giant, well-defended fortresses hiding from me.
Yep.
And then we decided that it would take too many hours to finish the game, and we just stopped playing.
Yeah, it's pretty good. But I think my problem was is that I tried to be the offensive guy. I was trying to kill other people's daimyos, and as a result, I killed one of yours, and then mine, the guy who did the killing, died. And then I tried to kill one of Pete's, and the guy who did the killing died.
Yep.
So I think the strategy in the game is to, you know, not go in for the kill until the guy is weak. You know, if you try to go in for the kill when the guy's not ultra weak, you know, then you're asking for it.
But someone has to go in for the kill. And if no one does, then they're all grabbing territory. And there's a lot. It's mostly posturing, as far as I can tell. It's
another
just a
good,
lot of...
Another good strategy is to gang up two of your daimyos against one of his. If you catch him in a bad position, you know, that's key. That's why when you level him up, you can move him real far to get him into positions like that.
Yep. Like, I played a nice bit where Pete's daimyo was kind of dangerous because I'd been neglecting one of my armies, and it wasn't that well equipped. And it's just kind of moving around gathering territory along my borders. And Pete's army is coming for me. And instead of coming straight at me, he jumped to take an island from me because islands are actually very defensible positions. Because attacking over the water, you're at a huge disadvantage if you're the attacker. And the island was poorly defended. I had no army there, just some troops, so he took my island. So I jumped my daimyo, like I bid so I could go first, and I put an army at the territory that he just jumped from, so he couldn't jump back without fighting my army at that disadvantage. And then he tried to take other island territories to get around, and I put another army there, and I basically trapped him in the ocean.
Yep. It's just really cool, and I like the theme, and I like everything about it. Except for the fact that it takes freaking forever.
Though I think now that we know how to play, we'll be able to play it faster.
We will be able to play it faster, but this isn't a game you can play too often without it getting really painful. I mean,
yeah, like Illuminati.
Yeah, actually, I could stand to play Illuminati more often than I could play this, I think.
I don't know, because I always think that, but then I play Illuminati again, I remember how much it pisses me off.
Maybe, I haven't played it in a while. I think it's just because it's time to play Illuminati again, you know?
Yeah, though we don't own it anymore. Our friend who we haven't actually heard from in a long time owns it.
Maybe I'll buy it this Saturday or something.
Yeah, or maybe when I'm in Rochester, I'll buy that Mafia one that's almost the same game. But
oh, yeah, when you go to Rochester, you'll buy a bunch of new German games for us.
Yeah, because I got to say, Millennium in Rochester is really the only gaming store in the world that we know of that's good.
Yeah.
We can't find them around here.
I mean, there is one around here, but it doesn't have nearly the selection of German games, and they have too much of the store devoted to stuff like
video games, paintball, Yu-Gi-Oh,
airsoft,
yeah, comics,
yeah. But Millennium just sells role-playing games, board games, miniatures games, and card games, really, and a small section for stuff like, you know, fancy mahjong sets and such.
Yep, and they definitely cater to the Eurogamer in all of us.
Yeah.
And that was Geek Nights with Rim and Scott. Special thanks to DJ Pretzel for our opening theme.
Be sure to visit our website at www.frontrowcrew.com. If you like our podcast, you'll love our forums. Make sure you visit them. You can send your email feedback to geeknights@gmail.com. And if you want, you can leave us a voicemail at 206-333-1537.
Geek Nights airs every weeknight, Monday through Thursday.
Geek Nights is recorded with absolutely no studio and no audience. But unlike those other talk shows, it's actually recorded at night.